Greetings and thanks for joining us. John and Dale here, sharing with you observations and insights from our experiences as part of GESPCU, the University of All Things Guaranteed Energy Savings Performance Contracting. In our last podcast, we introduced the investment grade audit phase of a performance contract. We focused on typical scenarios that determine how an IGA is priced and how the owner ultimately pays for it. Today, we'll draw attention to some of the owner's initial responsibilities in kickstarting the IGA process. What we'll be sharing is guided by the information found in the set of model performance contracting documents on the Energy Services Coalition website at energyservicescoalition.org/resources/model-documents. They're proven and well-vetted models derived from the states that are most successful at implementing energy efficiency and environmental stewardship through the use of performance contracting. So Dale, let's start from the top.
Always a very good place to start. So to effectively begin the IGA process, the energy services company needs to collect a significant amount of information regarding the buildings and systems the owner wishes to include in the scope of the IGA analysis. Often, owners collect and share some preliminary information with the ESCOs during the ESCO selection process. This might typically include the list of facilities and systems to be considered, and at a minimum, the total square footage of each of the buildings. So we pick up now after the ESCO has been selected and an IGA contract has been executed. As a reminder, these projects are most successful when the owner and the ESCO are working in partnership to collectively deliver the best project possible. Providing and verifying information, disclosing concerns or past challenges and issues, working together to make iterative decisions, availing staff for interviews, sharing perspectives and priorities. These are all characteristics of good partnering. The guidance in the model IGA contract specifies the owner as the source for their information that the ESCO requires to begin their analysis. To the best of their ability and as accurately as possible, the owner should provide various information to their ESCO about the buildings and systems in the scope of the IGA. But to be sure, as is also stated in the model documents, it's then the ESCO's responsibility to confirm and verify all the information provided. John, for our listeners' benefit, let's walk through a sample list of some of this pertinent information.
As we mentioned earlier, Dale, we'll be using the ESC model IGA contract as our guide. Most of the information the ESCO needs seems pretty straightforward and logical and should be fairly accessible to the owner. The gross area or square footage of each building is a good starting place. If this information is not readily available to the owner, a good resource is the insurance company policies, which typically have this information on record. The size of the building not only provides the ESCO a preview of the potential time they may need to audit the building, but it will also be used in their calculation of multiple per square foot metrics. These will include, at a minimum, energy and water use and cost per square foot. These simple analyses will allow an apples-to-apples comparison of the buildings. In an ideal world, if the owner's records can provide additional breakout of areas of similar purpose and operational needs, such as classrooms, hallways, gyms, auditoriums, cafeterias, or conference rooms and common spaces, it'll definitely be a plus for the ESCO's analysis process.
In addition to the building areas, information regarding building construction types, materials, and timelines, the age of the buildings and information about major additions or renovations either completed or planned will be important for the ESCO and to document in the IGA. What sort of roof? How old is it? When's it expected to be replaced? Are these single-pane wooden windows or double-paned energy-efficient aluminum-clad windows? And what about the doors, insulation, penetration ceiling, and fans? And don't miss the opportunity to add pictures to these descriptions they can prove ever so helpful in capturing the pre-construction condition of the facilities and systems. Additionally, what are the operating schedules and occupancy levels of the buildings and their energy-consuming equipment? And remember, if those schedules and occupancy counts are different for different spaces, those details will be important. Ideally, building and equipment operating schedules are readily available through perhaps a building automation system or equipment and operation logs from which detailed information may be gleaned. If not available, then the ESCO will undertake the task of learning this information through their on-site visits and discussions with the owner and staff, as well as with building occupants. The owner and building occupants should call attention to any issues in their spaces, such as comfort or lighting level issues. You know, it's far more important than our words here can emphasize that existing issues be shared and effectively documented, and subsequently that the parties agree on how they'll impact the project. The ESCO may need to perform detailed metering and monitoring of some equipment to provide the data needed for an accurate analysis. Beware, there is sometimes a temptation to shortcut some of these descriptions or processes. Bluntly speaking, this is not advisable.
Also, as we know, Dale, so many performance contracting projects are not limited to brick and mortar. Often, there are standalone systems such as exterior lighting upgrades for street lighting, parking lots, security, or playing field lights. Water projects, including irrigation system upgrades and, becoming more common, water meter replacement projects. As much information about these systems that can be provided by the owner will go a long way in assuring the ESCO best understands these systems.
And maintenance expenditures is another history that should be collected and provided. You know, your purchasing or finance folks may have invoices or check records for maintenance services, parts replacements, or service contract costs on certain pieces of equipment. Many performance contracts include some level of maintenance cost reduction, and perhaps rightfully so. While new equipment and systems will have maintenance costs, they rarely meet or exceed those of old or failing systems. And so as a part of equipment or systems upgrade, the operation and maintenance costs may be reduced. Now, you might assume that in the first year, there'll be no maintenance costs, but this would be an error. The efficiency of equipment and systems is predicated on the reliance that these systems will be maintained and as prescribed in the contract. It should also illustrate who's responsible for that maintenance. All this to say, the importance of establishing a baseline cost of operation and maintenance on the buildings and equipment that's going to be affected is essential, so as to be able to prove the reduction of operation and maintenance costs. This is but one of many baselines that will need to be established and agreed to by the parties. You know, John, I suspect you and I have both read through IGAs that call out or question what appear to be excessive service visits. Or maybe even you discover a note on a maintenance report indicating that replacement parts are becoming hard to find, or that equipment failure is imminent. These clues are real keys to ensuring that your energy performance project attends to those issues that may have been haunting you in your facilities for a while.
So true, Dale. And another positive outcome of having an ESCO review the maintenance records is taking a look for service contracts. I can't tell you how many times I've heard an owner say, "We haven't seen that maintenance contractor here in 3 years, yet we still continue to receive and pay invoices every 6 months for service that they claim was provided to our facility." Discovering those types of situations result in cost savings that the parties must mutually agree whether they shall or shall not be included in the project savings.
All great points, John. You know, what's discovered in the process of a quality audit is generally quite telling. Discovering and documenting things that don't work or have been limping along, working poorly, literally being held together by baling wire and duct tape, become ever evident when an ESCO is tasked with identifying the working status and condition of a scope of work while looking for comprehensive ways to improve.
You know, the results of this work assembling this abundance of information may be the only time that an accurate and complete picture of the pre-construction state of the buildings and systems can be captured. And just as you said earlier, Dale, the temptation may be great to shortchange this effort, but the regret of that decision could last for decades. It's no doubt the collection of detailed background, status, maintenance and service, even occupant complaint information is real work. But no matter how broad or narrow the scope of work may be, this level of detail is essential to document and may help result in a more accurate assessment and analysis for the IGA.
Yeah, so John, how about we just share a few quick examples?
All right, well, here's one that we see far too often. After a quick interview or two, the resultant IGA description of when facilities are used and their occupancy reads, 1,470 people occupy this facility for 2,376 hours per year. Just to make the point, this reflects a year of the 8-to-5 workday, and we know that this schedule does not apply to most of the buildings most of the time. This sort of generalization across each day, each month, for all spaces defeats the ability to really understand the operations and usage of the facilities, which will result in painting an inaccurate picture of pre-construction conditions. What you really want to know is the true operating, working, and attendance schedules of individual areas in each building, such as the days they normally worked, the holidays they took, or when the cleaning crews arrived and when they left.
That's a great example, John. Here's another. Imagine reading a report that covers 12 different facilities and seeing one little chart about standards of comfort. Yeah, that's how we typically define things like light levels, fresh air requirements, space temperature, and humidity. And that little chart summarizes these facilities are operated with a winter and summer set point temperature as follows respectfully. Huh. There are just so many things wrong about this. For one, yes, engineers must know set point temperatures to manage the math of estimating consumption and projected savings. But for many facilities, the temperature in the space is far more important to the occupants in their working or learning comfort than the set point on a thermometer or control system device. And to think that the space temperature is exactly the same throughout an entire facility, well, that's just hard to imagine. What you're really after here are the space temperature and humidity ranges that the owner and occupants agree reflect reality of what they've been living with in each functional space or area in each building with some typical number of occupants during all seasons. Recognizing the level of granular detail needed for various workspaces that have different purposes really becomes the science of a study in the end.
Well, Dale, today we introduced some of the initial activities to begin the investment grade audit process, where the owner will do their due diligence to collect all of the attributes of information about their facilities and systems and share them with their ESCO to validate and confirm each and every one. Completing this process will ensure the ESCO's engineering analyses will begin on the right foot. The detailed information will also provide a historical record for the people who may be in these roles, say 5, 10, or even 20 years down the road.
Well said, my friend. So in our next podcast, we'll dive a little deeper still into first steps with an IGA and focus our discussion on some of the considerations about the importance of the collection and analysis of utility consumption data and baselines. GESPCU. See you next time.